right, welcome to episode 12 of the LSQ podcast. Hi, I'm Jenny LSQ, and I'm excited in this episode to share with you an interview with multi-instrumentalist, producer, singer-songwriter, composer, and all-around awesome dude, Rostam. I first met Rostam Bobmanglich, I guess about 12 years ago now, when it was basically love at first listen for me with his former band Vampire Weekend, and I had the chance to write about them early on for Rolling Stone magazine when I was there full-time. And Rostam and I became friends and have had numerous conversations on the record and off in the years since, but never one as focused as the conversation you're about to hear. A one-on-one at Rostam's place in Los Angeles, where we got to dig in and talk about his childhood musical influences, his creative evolution, his decision to step away from being a full-time member of Vampire Weekend a couple of years ago, his debut solo album, Half Light, his work as a producer with artists like Haim and Charlie XCX and Carly Rae Jepsen, and much more. So I hope you'll hang out and listen to the entire thing. And after the interview with Rostam, you get an excerpt from a conversation I had back in 2014 with Beck leading up to the release of his Grammy-winning album Morning Phase. But first, let's dig into this Rostam chat. And where we begin here is with Rostam commenting on how, in the couple of years since he revealed he was stepping away from Vampire Weekend, it's sort of felt to him like time was flexible.
It's so weird to put, like, the chronology together because, like, kind of changing my relationship to Vampire Weekend from, you know, being a member of the band to not being a member of any band, like, that was something that was, I guess now, like, 4 years ago, that was a decision that, you know, was, you know, felt like an inevitability. And yeah, it's interesting to like look back on just kind of feeling like nervous about what the right way to talk about that was.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I did the best job, if I'm totally honest, but I remember like texting a few people that I trusted, and I think you were one of them, being like, what do you think I was like saying this? And maybe you gave me some notes. Some other friends gave me some notes like about what to say and what not to say. Yeah, it's weird. Some things that you want to like, you want to express, you want to like say it like in a concise way that doesn't say too much, but gets, you know, cuts to the point.
Yeah.
No, that's the same thing. Not saying too much and cutting to the point. That's the same thing. What do I really mean? You want, I don't know, to...
You don't. You don't. My sense at the time when you were like, "What do you think of if I say it this way?" was like, "Well, you don't want to over-explain or like seem like you're defensive, but also out of respect for the fact that people will be." I remember saying to you, like, "You know, people are going to be sad. There are going to be people who are like,
yeah.
No, it's not the same." And it's like a thing you have to respect that when in communicating what you know what you're choosing to do. But I mean, zooming out from that somewhat, I'm curious now in 2018, as all of this exciting stuff is beginning to come out. I mean, does it feel like, well, yeah, this is why I made those. This is what I wanted to be my life to be by 2018, is that I have my own music and then I'm available for whatever projects come up? Or is it just like, you're like, oh, it's nice it worked out this way. I figured something good would happen. How much of a master plan, once you made that decision, like, how much of a master plan do you feel like, no, you are executing your vision for, like, this phase of your career?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think I got into a zone where I was thinking about my career, and I really feel like I've exited that zone now, where I just can let it exist, let it happen, and not think about it. But I think I had to for a second just be like, you know, what do you want to do? Because no longer being a member of a band kind of changes, you know, what you can do and what you can't do. And there's, you know, there's nothing that you can't do. You could do whatever you want to do. So it's like, what are the things that are important to you? And that ultimately, I think that's a healthy way to think about what your career is. There's a lot of unhealthy ways to think about your career. But like, what is important to you? That's like the most healthy way to think about it.
And so what are the top things that are most important to you in terms of whether you feel like content with and excited about what you're working on? Because I know one ingredient of what you weren't sure was working for you was actually just touring and being on the road. And I remember you saying you weren't sure if that's like a lifestyle that you wanted to be kind of stuck in.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I think it's evolved for me. I think it was some, you know, kind of coming off the road in 2014. And then the next time I got on a stage, I was, you know, with Hamilton Lighthouser. We were playing these kind of special one-off shows around the release of the record that we made together. And I started to, something kind of like, it was like cracking an egg or something. I don't know if that's the right analogy, but it felt like that. I felt like it was something, this new thing. And I felt like, oh, I'm on this stage because I love these songs. And that was always the case. I would always love the songs that we made in Vampire Weekend, and I love the songs that I made with Hamilton. And it was always about that love. But then it was also in the, you know, I couldn't ignore the fact that I was playing these shows with him, and it could go anywhere from there. You know, we could get on we're going to get on a stage together at the end of July at the Newport Folk Festival.
I'm going to try and go to that. I love that festival.
Yeah, I've never been to that festival. Oh, and awesome. I've heard it's amazing, and there's so many amazing things about it. So just the idea that the future could be anything you wanted it to be, and then disconnecting this kind of the stress of a cycle, mm-hmm. which is, I don't know if every listener who listens to this is going to understand what that word means, but if you don't know what an album cycle is,
yeah,
it's the whole thing of making an album, doing press for it, making videos for it, releasing songs, doing promotions, going out, you know, going around the world, maybe even before the album comes out, playing songs live on the radio early in the morning, going on tour, and after you've, you know, toured as much as you could tour, you do it all again. So yeah. That's an album cycle. So when people talk about being on cycle or off cycle or what that means.
Yeah, it's a lot. It can be a long time though. If things are going well, the better it's going, the longer it can be that cycle. And more so what artists, I feel like now more than ever, are saying, perhaps because it's so easy now to imagine breaking things up into different units of song, you know, one song at a time, two songs a year, whatever it might be, that artists feel more enslaved by the cycle now because they realize, like, wait, why are we doing it? We don't need to insist on record full-length album, release full-length album, promote full-length album, tour the world for a long time. Maybe you can have a year where you do some festivals but don't release more than a couple songs. That sort of more free-flowing situation seems to be, I think, a lot of artists, like Tegan and Sarah, when I spoke to them, they're like, we're taking a break. And we're going to think about, do we need to do things that way? Is there another way to do things? Why do we feel trapped in the album cycle, you know? And that's, you're kind of, I think it's cool. I mean, I've known you for a minute. You're kind of like an ADD kind of guy. And the idea of like not having to be, not stuck with, but just like, this is the only thing I'm going to work on for now. Like, you seem like a guy who probably you want to be able to just pursue whatever kind of like creative whim.
Yeah, I don't know if ADD is the right word, because I think I'm actually like very focused and concentrated, maybe to a fault, obsessive even.
Yeah, and I don't want to use ADD cavalierly because it's an actual diagnosis and everything.
Yeah, but I think I probably have OCD more than ADD, and like that's I think the kind of energy that it takes to finish an album a lot of times. And so I'm careful about entering that world because I don't know how not to give 110%. And it's, you know, it takes over your life. You don't get to choose when it's done. It becomes like an animal. It tells you when it's done. So right.
Even when it's someone else's song.
That's the thing. To me, it's like, it doesn't matter if it's a Rostam song or a song that I'm producing for another artist, I want to make it as good as it can be, and whatever that takes, I'm ready to go there. If I commit to finishing the song, it's like, it's going to be hard for me to find a middle ground. So that's why, yeah, like you said, I feel like now, if I want to enter those kind of projects, I can. And I know what it's like, but it's just kind of fun to be able to. I feel like we haven't given the listeners too much context so far about who I am or what I do, but maybe it's worth giving that kind of sort of like.
Oh, we will.
You will. You can do that. No, sure.
We're gonna.
I don't have to do
all. We're gonna get to that. Don't you worry. I mean, nowadays when you have a free moment where maybe a project's winding down and there are others that aren't quite ready to go yet, do you imagine artists that you know what you would do with a song of theirs that you haven't even, you know, I mean, or do you sort of fantasize about like, oh, if I could just get into the studio with this person, I already have an idea of what I might suggest they try?
Yes and no. Yes, I do have people like that I think of, you know, I think we could make something cool together. And I feel kind of like I'm not in a rush to get there. Most of the people that I work with, I know personally in some capacity, and it's a kind of an organic process that brings us into the studio together. So I feel like right now I have like a good crew of people that I'm making music with, people that I've worked with really for like, some of them for like 12 years and some of them for 12 months. And I think it will continue to be that way.
And I have known each other for approximately 12 years.
Yeah.
Since 2007, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
When we met because I wrote something about Vampire Weekend for Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
But also we had like some mutual friends in common in New York, and I had been lucky enough to, just by being in New York and just having met a couple of people who went to college with you guys, like heard about Vampire Weekend early and went to see you guys play at Mercury Lounge. Was that the first Mercury Lounge show that VW played that night that we did our interview, our historic interview?
It feels at right. The library. Yeah, that feels right.
What do you remember most fondly from like those early days when things with Vampire Weekend were starting to pop off on kind of like another level, and people like Rolling Stone were starting to take notice? I mean, do you think in retrospect that you were even able to sort of appreciate that experience at the time, or was it very exciting for you guys or for you in particular?
It was very exciting, and the excitement kind of started when we played shows in college. And 3 out of 4 of us graduated college in 2006. And for the next year or so, we would get booked to play these shows at like literary houses, which, you know, would be like the Columbia equivalent of a frat party. It wasn't very fratty, but it was a party, and we would perform, and it would, you know, it would get packed. And those shows had a certain excitement that transferred to a lot of the shows that we played downtown in New York over the course of that next year. And I think that was kind of where the excitement stemmed from. That it was like, it felt like a real thing because we were playing those shows.
Right, and some of your friends from uptown would come and get the party started, and it felt like there were fans at the show already mixed in with people who were like, what the fuck is this?
Well, yeah, they were our friends, a lot of them, but some of them were not our friends. Some of them were kids who went to Columbia who had, you know, someone had shared the music with them, because I thought it was smart to make a CD, the so-called blue CDR. It was like this idea of making something that was kind of finished, but kind of unfinished. And it was kind of like you were getting let into something. You're getting let in on something early.
Right.
So the blue CDR has like 10 songs on it, and 9 of those ended up on the first Vampire Weekend album, and like 3 of them are different, but...
And you had already at that point been, even while you were still in school, like getting some paid work in this, working in the studio. Am I remembering that correctly, right?
My first job out of college was working for a film composer who actually used to be the lead singer of a rock band called Shudder to Think. His name's Craig Wedren. And he's still a film composer. And
how had that position come your way?
It came because he scored a film that Mike Cahill and Britt Marling made about, it was a documentary about boxers and ballerinas in Miami. And they kind of just, I knew Mike and Britt because they went to college with my brother, and they all worked on films together, Mike, Britt, and Zal, my brother. And they connected me with Craig, and I made the CD of like all this music that I was working on. Some of it sounded like purely classical music. Some of it was like Vampire Weekend songs. Some of it was Discovery songs. Some of it was solo music. I made this 15-track CD for Craig, and I was basically like, this is what I can do. And he was like, do you want to come work for me? And so he gave me my first kind of real music job.
So what were your responsibilities?
I was working on this film called The Ten, which is 10 short films about the Ten Commandments, hosted by Paul Rudd.
Love that movie.
I wrote some of the music in that movie.
What? I love that movie so much when I saw it in the movie theater that I went to see it in the movie theater again, which like I never do.
Just
out of, not out of judgment, but just out of like laziness or whatever. You guys, The Ten is fucking hilarious. Winona Ryder has a hilarious vignette in it. Paul Rudd is amazing. It's so good.
Yep. There you go.
There you go. So The Ten. So you did that, and was that
it? I contributed to a couple of moments in that. And then I thought, you know, I was at this point where I was like, do I want to go to grad school for music? Do I want to pursue film scoring? Do I want to be a record producer? Do I want to be in a band? I was in a band. It was Vampire Weekend. We started. It was most of our last semester of college when it started, and I felt like this was an opportunity to like write songs, record music, produce an album, and you know that all happened. And the other guys in the band really like they trusted me to produce the first Vampire Weekend album. I'd never produced an album before, so they believed in me. And I have to thank Craig for giving me a computer, you know, that was like souped up to score films. And I used that to record and mix a lot of the first Vampire Weekend album. So
I want to go back in time. And some of this is stuff that we've talked about in other contexts.
Sure.
But I do want to kind of go back and dig into some of the little baby Rostam influences. So yeah, so tell me about your earliest interest in picking up an instrument and playing music. How old were you?
I think I was 5 or 6, and I wanted to play the flute because my brother was learning clarinet. And I wanted to, you know, be kind of like my brother, but maybe a little different. And then, so I ended up learning recorder because I couldn't play flute yet. I was just too young. And so the recorder was the first instrument that I learned. And I remember I had like this part in the kindergarten circus, which was playing a recorder. And I think I was like 1 year ahead of everyone else in the class who would learn recorder as part of the curriculum the next year. But I was just like 1 year ahead. But so the recorder was like the first instrument that I learned. And then...
Oh, yeah. Didn't they cast you as a snake charmer or something?
Yeah. How'd you know that?
I remember. I think you told me that. It's so, just like, oh, yeah, that was not...
You've interviewed cool. me so many times, man. You know my life better than I do at this point. So... But it does remind me of like this neighbor that my parents had that my dad asked this neighbor, he said, our kids want to play instruments. what do we do? Do we get them the instruments? What if they don't want them? You know, after a while, what if they were, you know, what if it's just a whim? Like, what should we have it in the house? Like, should we leave it in the house? What do? We don't know. And this neighbor who was a bunch of years older said, you just buy them or you rent them, leave them in the house, see what happens. Worst case scenario, you can just sell them in a couple years if they don't touch them, or sell them when they go to college or whenever they get older, whatever it is, just leave it in the house. And my parents took that to heart. And so they, you know, it definitely impacted me to have instruments around. And
so what instruments did they get?
Well, we had, you know, we had like a digital piano, which kind of looked like a real piano and kind of played like a real piano, but it was a digital one. And I, you know, to this day, that's in my parents' house in D.C., which actually they're going to sell that house this year. So it's good. That piano is going to go away. But like that was, I remember learning how to play Imagine by John Lennon on that piano. And the way that I learned it, this is kind of indicative of my path. I learned it because at that point I could read guitar tablature. And I got this magazine called Guitar World, which I was a subscriber to.
Yeah.
And they had the tabs for the guitar version of Imagine. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I feel like maybe John Lennon played it live in Central Park on acoustic guitar once. But like this was just like an adaptation of a piano song. Mm-hmm. And I was like figuring out the piano version from the guitar version.
Damn.
And that's basically like, that was like basically how I learned to play piano, was through guitar. And then when I was 17, which is really late, I was like, I should probably take some lessons in piano.
But, and the guitar was self-taught?
I had a guitar teacher. So I played the flute from age 6 until about 13. I burned out real hard on flute. I was like, I never want to play flute again. And I was like,
fuck you, flute.
I was like, I want to learn electric guitar. And my flute teacher was really cool. She was like, I think I know a guy. He's good. He's cool. He's like kind of a rock guy, but he does classical too. And like, I think he'd be a good teacher. And so then I started taking guitar lessons, and that was like the beginning of kind of like, I think, a different relationship maybe to music. I guess it made me more interested in songwriting, whereas when you're playing the flute, it's kind of hard to be interested in songwriting.
Right.
It's hard to like sing and play flute at the same time. I think some people can do it.
But also, I guess with guitar, once you have kind of once you know what the building blocks are of the songs you like, I can see how that would translate into, like, what if I rearrange them this way and sang something different? So this is you said from when you were starting when you were 13 that you started playing guitar?
Uh-huh.
Right, so what were you listening to at that point?
I was listening to, like, Bush.
Oh, yeah, Glycerine, get in there.
Glycerine, Machine Head.
Yeah.
Like, Local H. Just, like, a lot of alternative rock.
Yeah. And so were you learning to play those songs specifically?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned how to play all those songs. Nirvana. And then my guitar teacher also was like, you should learn this too. And it was like Eric Clapton.
Tears in Heaven?
Maybe I asked to learn that one, actually.
That's a good song.
It's well, good. It's a good guitar song. It's a good guitar song too. Like you can play that. You can really shred.
Right.
You can learn a lot out of playing that. So, yeah, Tears in Heaven, one of, like, Jimi Hendrix, Little Wing.
Right.
It was kind of like, he'd be like, okay, we'll do one for you and one for me. So I wanted to learn Mr. Jones by Counting Crows. I wanted to learn High and Dry by Radiohead. And he wanted to teach me Jimi Hendrix. And he wanted to teach me, like, some classical guitar and some jazz, which I was into jazz, and he was kind of like pushing me further down that road, which was cool.
Right.
And the most technical shit that I got into was not Van Halen, because that was just wasn't my music, but the Stray Cats. So Brian Setzer,
damn,
his guitar solos are kind of like the most technical stuff that I can still play on guitar,
and
to this day.
And so were you beyond, those are obviously artists whose songs were on the radio and were hugely popular at
the
that
Stray
time.
Cats?
Well, not the Stray Cats, but I mean, you know, like the Bush type stuff.
Oh, yeah,
were,
the Bush. Oh,
were
yeah,
you Bush. Were you already at that point starting to be like the kind of music fan who would try and go see these bands in concert, or what was
a
the sort
bit.
Of, what kind of yeah, pushed I, you I'm, into being more first, exploratory with your music taste?
My first concert was Semisonic. At the 9:30 Club.
Damn.
Which I've been reluctant to talk about, but I was really into Closing Time, the song. Yeah. I was really into Singing in My Sleep. They had a lot of great songs on that record. And yeah, I think I convinced my brother to take me to the concert.
At the 9:30 Club.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm assuming that was sort of became your regular spot to go see shows? To an extent, growing up near D.C.?
Yeah. I mean, you got to understand, though, I didn't really live in D.C. after I was 18, so I didn't see a ton of shows.
Right. So when you got to New York, were you, I mean, by this time, had you started to, did it take over your life? I mean, or was it just a sort
music.
Of... Yeah, like the interest in music, music technique, and like skill. When did you start to feel that that was a thing you were kind of obsessed with?
From the moment that I got to Columbia, I knew I was going to major in music. I have friends to this day that I met on that, you know, first day. There was something called Diatonic Harmony and Counterpoint, which is a year-long class that you have to take at Columbia if you want to be a music major. And then it's followed by another year-long class called Chromatic Harmony and Counterpoint.
Can you give me the for idiots version of what diatonic harmony and counterpoint is? What
it's is basically okay. So like people talk about like classical music having rules. And that's one way to think about it, but you can also just think about it as like it's idiomatic. Mm. Like in the way just like you can learn French and some people can speak French but they don't speak idiomatically, right? Like, French people can smell you. Even if you're saying the right words, they know that you're not French. Because you're not really speaking exactly their language.
Right.
And that's the same thing with classical music. So it's like...
So they give you those couple of classes at the beginning to teach you some of the idioms, you mean?
It's not some of the idioms. It's basically like, what did the classical composers do and what did they not do? Like,
okay,
and you can, you know, I can hear it in other artists that I know that have studied classical music. There's certain things that they do that people who haven't studied classical music don't, and sometimes their music sounds classical as a result, and sometimes it doesn't exactly, but I'm like, oh, that person's a classical head.
Interesting.
And that's definitely something I feel about Julian Casablancas. Like, the stuff that he writes, a lot of those, like, guitar lines from dating back from, like, this first Strokes album, they're, like, really classical. And they're, you know, they're hidden in others. It's hidden in a different context, but I think a lot of people who study classical music, they're like, oh, yeah, that's a classical thing. That,
yeah.
That little moment there, that's such a classical thing. And or like Regina Spektor, I feel like she has a lot of those moments, whether she's just on a piano or she has different instruments. I can kind of hear that coming through, which is interesting because I'm mentioning these kind of quote-unquote New York artists.
Right.
And I think there is a kind of connection between classical music and the New York sound.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been around since the Velvet Underground had John Cale on stuff, and since, you know, like someone like Arthur Russell, who played classical cello and then also made dance music and made everything in between. So like,
yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought about that before, and I wonder if it does sort of just have to do with proximity to just the high culture music stuff in New York, that you have things like Lincoln Center, you know what I mean, that it's like the idea of classical music as being a contemporary category in certain cities is more alive than in other cities. And in a way, I imagine that if you are based in certain cities and other parts of even just the U.S., you might have a little bit of Zydeco in your music, you know what I mean? Or you might have a little bit of, you know, roots Americana in your music without even having to think about it too much. I know with Casablancas, for instance, I know he went to music college for a couple of semesters, and I don't think that was his focus, but... and with Regina Spektor, obviously she was classically trained as a kid.
Yeah, so I think what you mentioned about New York is true. It's true for classical music, and it's true for all kinds of music. It's true for every kind of music. You take the subway in New York, and suddenly you're hearing African music. You're hearing Ukrainian folk music. You're hearing classical music played by, you know, a solo violinist. You're hearing jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You're hearing all these different kinds of music all the time. It's in your face. You can't escape it. And it is inspiring. And it does affect you positively. I think it affected all of us that have made music and lived in New York.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, even just going back to touching on the early days of Vampire Weekend, when some people who were writing about the music were fixated on whether a portion of the influences felt pretentious or appropriative, I guess. But you think about an LA artist like Beck, who grew up here in a multicultural city where, similarly, in your car, you can drive mm-hmm. around, and if you have your windows down, you'll hear all kinds of music, and it's gonna get in there. You know, I mean, it is, you know, obviously the topic of like that kind of appropriation is so fascinating in that I don't know what, you know, what's where the line is, what's appropriative and what's not. You know, I have sympathy for artists who try and be respectful, but also who want to include in their music some of the available tapestry of sounds, even if it doesn't come from where they come from, you know. Was there ever a moment in those early days with Vampire Weekend and in your early evolution as an artist yourself where you felt like you had to assess that criticism legitimately and think about whether to factor it in at all? I mean, did that stuff bum you guys out, or you in particular?
It took time for me, and I think it was something that me and Ezra were kind of figuring out how to talk about, because we both had complex relationships with whiteness. And I, for example, would never in my life identify as white. I understand that I pass as white. And it took me a few years really to understand what that meant about, like, who I am.
Mm.
And I think, you know, for a lot of Iranians who escaped America during an extremely, like, xenophobic, Islamophobic era, they have this relationship towards their ethnicity where they really want to downplay it. There is a tendency to just be like, you know, for some people to be like, we're American now, which is really not my parents. They're very proud of their culture, but I think that for all Iranians, like who experience a lot of oppression, there's this desire to just be like, oh, here's a place where we pass. We can say we're Italian if we have to, which is something that some Iranians do, which is completely crazy to me, but there are some Iranians who say we're Italian. It sounds totally crazy, but so yeah, this is like a really, I'm talking about really specific, loaded, complex relationship towards whiteness, and that was something that in Vampire Weekend, a lot of, it's important to note, white music critics were not well equipped to talk about, and were not able to see the shades of gray of, and sort of kind of like we're trying to find they were trying to fish with dynamite, and I think some of it was destructive. Some of the articles that were written about Vampire Weekend were very destructive, and to me personally, like I didn't really know how to talk about it yet when a lot of that stuff was happening, and I think at this point, like, there's a better perspective, but I was also young.
Yeah. Since we are in a new era now, not just when it is easier to talk about one's own complicated relationship with any aspect of one's identity, that whether it's whiteness or anything else for that matter, you now have, you're the captain of your own ship as an artist. It's just Rostam. It's just you. And whatever you say is just representing only yourself. And I have enjoyed watching you come out more with your identity in your music. I think that's one of the things about Half-Light that I like so much, and in the lyrics and the sound of it, is that it feels more like you're like, it's got, obviously it sounds Vampire Weekend-y in the ways that's like, oh yeah, that's the Rostam. You know, the sort of classical Wes Anderson-y kind of thing that you do, but also elsewhere just being like, hey, here's a little bit of what I'm about, and I'm writing songs for me and for you. I mean, do you feel like there was a, has there been a point where you've kind of counseled yourself to just be, to be open about things in your own music and not to shroud things in mystery too much?
Yeah. I do enjoy, you know, speaking of, on topics.
I mean, let's just talk
that are
about,
interesting to me as a, you know, in songs.
Right.
I think songs are a really cool place that I get to talk about being the son of immigrants, talk about things that I think are unfair in the world, talk about like love in a universal sense, and love in a way that I think people who don't identify as straight can, you know, connect with, which I think there are differences there. And it's interesting because, like, this summer I'm going to spend about 6 weeks in Provincetown.
Okay.
Which is it's the last town on Cape Cod. I don't know if have you ever been there?
I haven't.
It's a cool place. It was the first gay town in America. And it's still probably like one of the gayest places in America.
Okay.
Where you can walk down the street and literally everyone's gay.
Right.
And the straight people have that kind of look on their faces, like, you know, they're just, their eyes are darting a little bit. They're like, you know, maybe we don't fit in here. And it's like you reverse, everything's
right,
reversed.
Yeah.
And it's, what's really cool about Provincetown, there's these different weeks. So there's like Girl Splash, which is kind of like lesbian week, and there's Bear Week, and there's Family Week. It really feels like, especially on Family Week, you really feel like you're living in the future. You feel like you're seeing, like, the next stage of human existence, where it's like mom and mom are pushing a stroller, and, you know, dad and dad have two kids and a golden retriever. It's like you're really in this future world. And a bunch of people who have told that I'm going to be spending like this much time out there, they've been like, oh, you're going to bring some studio equipment, you're going to record. And I don't think I am. But one thing I do want to do is write a book of short stories. And what attracts me to writing a book of short stories is that I feel like there's certain things that I want to say that I don't get to say in songs, because it's just too complicated.
Like, right, right.
I guess there's things that I want to say in a song that maybe you shouldn't say in a song. You know, maybe it's better to say in a short story. Things about your identity, like things about being gay, or things about being an immigrant, being Iranian, identifying with other immigrants. Just like, I think there's things that making the album Half-Light, releasing it, touring it around the world, and around America and, you know, spending time with people after the shows, it really, I think it kind of impacted me in a way. It kind of made me like, yeah, want to say more.
Right.
And I think it's been nice for me to take a break from music when I've been in Provincetown in the past, which has only been for 1 or 2 weeks, you know. And this time it's like a little bit longer. And I'm excited to just like, because, you know, I get these like, my fingers get.
He's moving his fingers right now.
My fingers, they get, if I haven't played piano or like used Pro Tools or played guitar in a few weeks, my fingers start to get twitchy. I have like, I need to be doing something. Like, I get this weird thing. It's like a black cloud. It's like guilt or like unsatisfied feelings. Like, I need to be doing something. I need to be making something with my hands, you know? Maybe pottery is the way to do it. I don't know. I'd rather type.
Do you write? Have you written short stories in the
past? I have. I've written a lot of short stories when I was in high school and college, and I haven't since. So I wanted to just kind of like jump back in.
Are you going to have like friends come visit and stuff during that time? But, do you have friends who
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I do. I have a lot of friends who want to come visit, and I'd love to have them visit, and they have visited before. But it's funny. It's so much easier for me to talk about this project. I would never do this about an album.
Right.
But it's so fucking easy and fun for me to talk about this like book of short stories, which may never come out.
Right, right.
And I don't feel anything about it because, like, you know, Publishers Weekly is not going to pick this up. But if I... Publishers Weekly...
What do you mean? They're not...
But, like, I don't know. If I, like, talked about all these songs that are coming out, it could just become like this deluge of like weird news stories, which I don't want.
Yeah.
So I'd rather just talk about this book of short stories that's going to be amazing.
Well, right. And most other things you're working on are other people get to decide whether or when it comes out. And
they're coming out.
Yeah.
They're coming out. But yes, I don't know when.
They're coming out.
Exactly. I don't know. I think as a producer, it's like not... It's not your role to hype up songs that haven't come out yet. Mm. Like, once they come out, then you can talk about them. But I just don't feel like it's too early until they're out. Because you never know what's going to happen until a song comes out. It's crazy.
You don't want to jinx it.
You don't want to jinx it. And you don't know what's going to, you know, you don't know what it's going to be until it is.
Yeah, you know? it's just living in a vacuum, and it's sort of like hard to assess until it enters like, the world.
A lot of times even, you know, how you're paid, how you split the, you know, the publishing for a song, what your deal is, all this stuff, you don't work out until the song is done. Until the song is out sometimes. Sometimes years later, people are like, how do you not have a producer deal for that song? It came out 2 years ago. Well, that's life.
Yeah.
That's life. And if you go into the studio with all these contracts written, I don't know what it would be. I've just about never done it.
Right.
Because it's like, you're messing with the art.
Right. You got to see what it becomes and then decide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe I've already said too much about the book of short stories, but that's just me, you know? I'm not going to get in trouble.
You haven't said too much.
I'm not going to get in trouble.
So roughly speaking, though, the plan for the rest of the year, other than more songs that will come out that it's too soon to talk about and going to Provincetown for 6 weeks, I mean, is there more Rostam touring in the second half of the year? And are you starting to think about, like, the next Rostam album? Because I know you worked on the songs for that for a while.
I'm starting to think about it. There's a new song I've been playing live. I played it at every Rostam show in 2018. It's called In a River. I think I played it at the show that you were at.
El Rey, yeah.
I wrote it on the mandolin. And it's the first song I ever wrote on mandolin. It's been so fun to play that song live. At this point, I must have played it like 20 or 30 times already. So I have to record that song and put it out. That's going to happen in 2018.
Yeah.
For sure.
More shows, though?
I have... The show at Newport Folk Fest with Hamilton Lighthouser, which we're really excited about that. And I have a show at the Fonda September 14th after 5 nights of Phoenix. can come see Rostov. So I'm a big Phoenix fan, so I'm psyched. It's fun. It's awesome. Fun to play the same zone as those guys. I've known those guys for a while, and I think Fonda's like one of the most fun places to play in LA because there's this awesome rooftop.
Oh yeah,
where you get to hang.
Get to smoke your dubs when sweet legal weed California. If you're me, at least. Plus others.
Exactly. Yes. LSQ crew on the roof of the Fonda getting baked before the show.
In how, full effect.
How else could it go? It couldn't go any other way.
I think that's all I have for you for this time, Rosti.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you for doing this. We'll come back and we'll talk about a whole bunch of other stuff some other time.
I'd love to. It's so fun. Let me be a regular on LSQ.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, as you heard Rostam mention, he does have a few North American shows coming up, so maybe bookmark officialrostam.com if you want to stay in the loop. And coming up next in episode 12 of LSQ, I figured I'd feature a clip from another mononymous artist turned producer, Beck. And also, it was just Beck's 48th birthday on July 8th, so happy belated B-Day to him. But in this clip, you'll hear it. It's actually interesting because the concept of an album cycle, which Rostam was referencing, the kind of oppressiveness of that, gets referenced early on in this Beck clip, where we were talking about why in more recent years he'd felt inspired to take on projects besides his own albums and really dig into unconventional things like his record club or his song reader. And so that's what we're discussing in this clip right here.
You know, I had a lot of years of pretty intensive touring and a lot of, like, kind of concentrated work. I think at the time I was thinking about why I was doing this or what I got out of it.
Right.
In the sense of what is, you know, what are we doing this? Not as necessarily an existential thing, but, you know, just try to remind myself of there's a long period before I was making records. I was just making music for fun. Because it enabled certain things to happen. It was just kind of a motivator, something connected people. And just, you know, so I started thinking about that because I thought, you know, you got a record deal and you're in the typical cycle as an artist, putting out albums and touring. And, you know, I got to a point where I felt like there's a lot of arbitrariness in the music business and how musicians are supposed to channel their creative impulse.
Oh, yeah.
And it's formalized in this way that it really isn't natural. So I feel like I just had to break that down a little bit for myself. Just not tell anybody who runs the show.
Yeah.
We're just going to get together and make music. So I was doing the record club thing for years before I put it out. We were just doing it for our own amusement.
Right. Just like round up some buddies who are fun to play with and who get it and just play it.
And we would all just say, this is the best time I've had making music in years.
Where would you do it? Just at your place? Or
I had a studio, or we rent a studio. I mean, so I just look for things like that where just something could happen and, you know, get into that. And I felt like it was a kind of liberation in a way. Of other bands would come in and they could see how, because sometimes there'd be two or three bands all together, and see how other people work. Because you tour with people, and that's one thing, but recording together is really intimate. And you really, when you get close quarters like that, you can see, like, oh, shit. Like when Annie Clark started playing guitar, we're just like, Fuck, she is a fucking great guitar player. When you see him on stage and there's a band and okay, they rehearsed, and but you know, it's something when you're really just in close quarters like that, or you're standing next to somebody and singing with them, you can hear their voice and your voice is with theirs, and
yeah,
there's very something very humanizing about the whole experience,
right?
And I just needed some humanizing,
yeah,
after you know, whatever 8-9 albums and tours and you know, being on a whole treadmill, which I happily participated in.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand it's the way of the world. But
yeah.
We have. I realized nobody was going to call me to make up these situations, you know. So
yeah.
You kind of have to do it yourself. It just takes a lot of time and a lot of persistence. You just got to. It's the thing of. I'm just going to ignore everything that's interesting going on. And I'm just going to go in there as miserable as it can be and just do it every day. Until it starts to work, you know, that's really what it takes, you know. I feel like it's just work ethic, really.
Yeah.
What comes down to it, consistency and work ethic.
Right.
But friends of mine who are really always doing stuff, I mean, they just have incredible follow through. You know, someone like Jack White is just,
yeah.
He's, you know, just whatever idea. I mean, he's really just go in there and he'll just work at it, you know.
Yeah.
The idea is always romantic, but the actual doing is not so romantic. It's not,
right.
It's not so comfortable.
Right. And you have to accept that then it turns out not being what you had your mind set on that it was going to be, just like the car that you're not really driving. I think that sets some people off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But mostly the effort.
All creative efforts are a compromise in the end. It's not quite what you wanted. That's why you do another one.
Right.
You know, for me, it's like I'll be making albums forever and still feel like it's not quite like I wanted it to be, you know, Rubber Soul or Hunky Dory. It's just not even, you know what I mean? There's always this, you know, unreachable that you're always trying to get to. Or you try to get to that and you got this. But that's the beauty of it.
That's about all I've got for you in this episode of LSQ. Thank you so much for listening, and major thanks to Rostam and Beck for their time. In a few weeks, you'll get a new LSQ, episode 13, with Best Coast's Bethany Cosentino. And after that, there's Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard to look forward to in mid-August. So please do subscribe if you haven't done so already. And if you want to share your thoughts in the form of a rating or a review, I'm told that kind of thing is helpful. You can always reach me with feedback or questions on Twitter, @JennyLSQ. I'll talk to you next time.